In the late first century, John wrote something that I'll admit, when I first came into the church and studied this passage, it was hard for me to understand. And maybe it's one thing that maybe you've had difficulty with in understanding or comprehending. You might read this passage in 1 John 4, verses 2 through 3, and wonder why the controversy. And you probably have looked into this before, but maybe you haven't. And if you haven't, maybe this will be a good learning for you, a good key learning. Or if you have learned it, then maybe it'll be a good reinforcement of what you've already learned. But it seems so out of place with our common culture that I thought this might be a good one to build a sermon around. John simply said, "By this you shall know the Spirit of God." This is where you're going to understand that there's truth and love and faith. This is the Spirit of God, he is telling his audience. "Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is not of God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard was coming and is now already in the world." In other words, there is false teaching. And anyone that teaches you that Christ didn't come in the flesh is a false teacher. Now, wouldn't you admit that that's a little out of place in today's world, that particular statement? And I say that because that Jesus was born of a human mother and became a human being at a point in time after eternity or after eternally being is virtually accepted by everybody who calls themselves Christian in this day and age. Am I correct? I mean, who do you know in any Christian church that doesn't agree with that? True? But John was dealing with a different society. But it's a concept that's readily understood. So you can go to the Catholics, the Lutherans, virtually every Christian denomination that I can think of or that you could think of, and everybody would accept this, would they not? That Jesus was born of a virgin mother and was a human being, that he divested himself of his eternity at one point. That's a well-understood part of Christianity. So John was dealing with a different society, and, you know, the alternative, if you were going to accept this literally for all ages, is that anybody that teaches you that Jesus was born of a human mother and became a human being is of the faith, the true faith. And that can't be right. You know that can't be right because there is truth and there is error. So if you understand the background behind this instruction, I submit to you it's essential to understand the background behind this instruction that he's giving in verses 2 and 3. Then you can take the rest of the chapter and extrapolate the lesson that is available for all ages and certainly apply it in our present age. So let's go back a bit. John was writing in the late 80s or early 90s AD towards the last part of the first century. That we know, we're fairly certain of that. I mean, very, very certain that that is the timing of this letter, right around the time that he was exiled on the Isle of Patmos and had the book of Revelation revealed to him and given to him. At that time, virtually all of the other eyewitnesses to the ministry of Jesus had died. Most of the apostles went through some kind of torturous death. We know that. But most of the eyewitnesses to the ministry of Jesus Christ had died because that ended in 31 AD. And so now it's 59 years after the fact. John lived longer, as far as we know, than all of his peers to over the age of 90, apparently, and probably died of natural causes in the latter years of the first century. So what was he talking about? Well, we know this, that embedded within the fabric of Greek society or Hellenistic society were concepts that are completely foreign to us for the most part. But they were pretty common at that particular time. John writes about them. and Paul especially writes about them in many of his letters. Paul was probably attacking several philosophies of the day. So John was probably attacking several different and very similar philosophies that were kind of intertwined when he writes verses 2 and 3. One of those dogmas or teachings was Docetism, D-O-C-E-T-I-S-M. And the base word of this in the Greek is to seem. Now, a lot of these philosophies, the Greek philosophies, get to be pretty complex. But the simplistic viewpoint of this is that in their view, in the Docetist view, Christ appeared to be of the flesh, but through their logic, he really couldn't have been. Because in their viewpoint, God, who is infinite and perfect, could never have been made subject to any kind of suffering. And so their idea that God was perfect, he was infinite, therefore he could not suffer. So they made Jesus to be some kind of seemingly human being, but he was kind of a phantom in their view. He left no footprints. He, you know, left no, there was no visage, nothing you could tell that he was fleshly at all. So they just didn't accept the fact that he was born in the flesh. And of course, John, being one of the few people that actually had touched and held Jesus Christ and held his flesh and knew that he was flesh, was able to refute this particular explanation. Now, in our day and age, we're thinking, wow, that's really kind of crazy, because we accept the notion, right? But they did not, because they were subject to these false ideas that would slowly be intertwined into some of the teachings of Christ as well. That's a very simple explanation, but it captures the general meaning. They didn't think Christ was ever a human being. So he could not have been born of the flesh. Another philosophical movement that had sprung up, and there is evidence that these ideas and beliefs began prior to the teaching of Christianity, but another philosophical movement that you've heard about, maybe a little bit more well-known, was Gnosticism. And Gnosticism had many, many different threads within its teaching. It springs from the base word of gnosis, or to know. There are many variations of Gnostic teaching, but one of the elements was that physical matter itself, and therefore flesh, was inherently evil. So therefore, God could not have inhabited something that of and by itself was inherently evil. And so you can see how both of these various ideas kind of come together. Gnosticism, if you'll turn to Colossians, Gnosticism was one of the difficulties in chapter 2 in Colossians that Paul was dealing with and that he strikes out against. And this problem just apparently never went away during the first century. It was something that came up again and again and again. So in Colossians 2, Paul says in verse 18, "Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and worship of angels." That was another aspect of Gnosticism. "Intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up in his fleshly mind." Now, the puffing up would come because in Gnosticism, another element of it was that you have to attain a higher spiritual level in order to have a perfect understanding of God and the nature of God. And you're never going to get there unless you deny yourself. If you don't deny the flesh, you'll never raise your spiritual consciousness. You know, that even has elements in some other philosophical and spiritual teachings that people hold on to today, right? I mean, it's kind of wacky, and it's not in the mainstream at all. And some of it is in the mainstream. I mean, some of it is a part of the mainstream of Christian teaching. You know, Lent, for example, a period of denial for 40 days, is certainly a good aspect of that. It has the same elements of Gnostic teaching, that if you deny the flesh, you're going to elevate the soul or the spiritual aspect of your life. So what happens during our celebrations and holy days. We don't shy away from taking advantage of all things that are lawful and pleasurable at the same time, right? In verse 16, it says, "Let no one judge you in food or in drink or regarding a festival or a new moon or Sabbaths." So those times of feasting are good and right and pure and holy and appropriate, Paul says. And yet, to the Gnostic point of view, that was anathema. In verse 20, or verse 19, it says, "And not holding fast to the head from which the whole body, nourished and knit together by joints and ligaments, grows with the increase that is from God. Therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world," and these false teachings that are being promoted as appropriate, "why, as though living in the world, do you subject yourself to regulations?" Those regulations were, "do not touch, do not taste, do not handle." In all of these things, which can be pleasurable and can be lawful in the right environment under God's law, which all concern things which perish with the using according to the commandments and doctrines of men. These things indeed have an appearance of wisdom in self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. Have no spiritual value, no spiritual help. The consequences are not good at all, and they interfere actually with your celebration and keeping of the feasts and the Sabbath and the holy days. So that was a point of Gnosticism. You can really get into, you can find books and volumes written on the various teachings of the Gnostics. I think that gives you enough of a basic understanding of what John was dealing with, even in the latter part of the first century AD, to understand that, you know, there was a time in which the litmus test for being a true teacher of God in the first century AD in Christianity was that if you accepted the idea, the biblical idea, and what the apostles had taught, that Christ had become a human being, then you were a true teacher of God. And we couldn't apply that litmus test today. We just couldn't do it because there are too many people in Christianity as a whole that accept that, but they don't accept other things that the Bible teaches. Is that fair? We're on the same page then? So if he doesn't, John is saying, you know that you're dealing with a false teacher. So in all Christianity now, this is a universal concept. So when you view this very important chapter, are you to conclude that because the entire body of Christian teaching embraces this essential truth, that you should accept their other teachings and precepts as well? Well, the rhetorical answer to the rhetorical question is no, and you know that. But there are other clues to understanding true and false teaching. You may want to hold your place there, but I'm going to cite, and I know everybody likes to turn and read it for themselves as well, Matthew 5, verses 17 through 19. There are other clues to help you in the Bible to understand who is a true teacher and who is not. Matthew 5 and verses 17 through 19, Christ said, "Do not think that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets." All of that remains intact, he was saying. "I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So, when examining 1 John 4 and looking for something to apply to ourselves in this modern day, remember that John was dealing with one specific problem that had crept into the teaching of the truth. And Paul had shown earlier, probably 40 years earlier, to the Colossians that accepting these false teachings would lead you away from the holy days themselves. And as we are well aware, when that happens, the true church of God loses its identity. History repeats itself. It happened anciently. It has happened in our modern time, as early as 15 years ago, as you all know. So that aside, of what further use is there, since we're not dealing with Gnostics and Docetists or whatever they would call themselves, since we're not dealing with those enemies of the faith in this day and age, what is the ultimate purpose and good use of that chapter for our lives today? Because we know that false teaching was designed to split those in the faith, and it had some effect. I mean, it hampered the efforts of the apostles, and they had to fight against this, all of them throughout their ministry, all in the first century. And so that was a constant battle that they waged. Well, I believe that there are some very important clues as to what comprises false teachers in any age, apart from this doctrine that we've already covered, that deserves our very close attention and scrutiny. The instruction in this chapter is so important that I implore you to take very special note of it, even though it is very simple. The difference in you making correct choices in the future could be based on your ability to be a good discerner of what it means to follow the precepts of 1 John 4. Let's go back to 1 John 4 and verse 1. I remember, as you're turning there, I remember years ago, a friend of mine in Corpus Christi had helped guide somebody that was younger in the faith. Individual was just a member, did not have any ministerial responsibilities or anything, but there was, and quite honestly, there have always been difficult times in the faith, in the Church of God. I mean, at the time that I was counseling for baptism and coming into the church when I was going to college, there was a controversy at the time that was brewing that I had no idea of. I mean, a lot of people did, and a lot of people didn't, but I had no idea what this controversy was all about, and it really had no specific meaning to me because I had discovered the truth, and I was in my first love, and I was learning about the Sabbath and the holy days and getting to know the people. And you know, I wouldn't say it was a controversy that embroiled the entire church or anything, but at times there have been. And if you're looking for safe passage and not a rocky road, then you probably came to the wrong place, because we have peace and harmony in our local congregations. But from time to time, even recent events have shown us that, and we have differences of opinion, as Mr. Capo has mentioned. And we have problems that arise that we have to struggle with and we have to fight with. And there are some clues here to solving some of those problems. But the first of them begins with this first verse. And this friend of mine in Corpus Christi, I digressed from my digression, this friend of mine in Corpus Christi had taken a younger member aside, a young man that was just a teenager who was coming into the church, and you know, his head was swimming with all of this local problem and difficulty that was happening in South Texas in 1973. And he just opened up his Bible to 1 John chapter 4 and verse 1, and he read him this verse: "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." There was a kind of a regional problem or controversy that involved, you know, some ministers and conferences that took place and whatnot. I won't even get into that because it's so far and foreign removed. The only certain common thing is that there was controversy, and this young man was a little bit befuddled by it, and he was counseled by his friend to test the spirits. Now, what does that mean? We are now armed with the understanding of what John was confuting, a very specific problem and philosophy of his day that has no relevancy for us. I think we'd all agree. You haven't run into any problems with Gnostics lately. You haven't run into any out visiting, have you, Mr. Capo? Probably not. But what was John saying? He's saying the same thing that your mother and your father and your teachers in school said. You know what it was? Very simple. Don't believe everything you hear or read. Put them to the test. Put them to a proof test. And that's exactly what John is telling the early New Testament church. Don't fall for everything, because you're likely going to be deceived if you do. You remember your teachers and your parents telling you this very simple saying. You know, and it's a part of politics and civics classes that, you know, young skulls full of mush are told by their teachers, you know, don't believe everything you hear. Don't believe everything you read. Just because it's in print, it doesn't necessarily carry authenticity. So you have to have a measurement by which to judge that. Now, 15 years ago, in recent memory, that is exactly what all of you did. You tried the spirits. You tested the spirits. You just put everything up to a litmus test, and if it rang true with this, then you believed it. If it didn't, then you rejected it. And that's what you must always do, and that is your responsibility as an individually called one from here on out. I'm not saying you have to be an independent Christian. We need each other. But you have to have your mind spiritually aligned with the power of God's Spirit so that you can make the appropriate decision at the right time. And it has to have an appropriate foundation, and that foundation is found in this chapter. Now, we have enjoyed 15 years now of presenting the truth of God, living in the truth of God, embracing the truth of God. The basics of the Sabbath and the holy days are building blocks of our faith, and those have not been challenged. Hooray. That's good. Because it's so nice to be able to celebrate the Sabbath and to hear God's word preached, and we all appreciate that. But we have been challenged in other areas, and in John's writings in 1 John 4 help us defend the faith in a way that, well, maybe you've thought about it, but maybe you haven't. And again, if you have thought about it, then maybe this just helps reinforce what you've thought. If you haven't thought about it, then, you know, that'll be good. At least I hope it'll be good. So there are clues here as to where we have been and may be attacked. Look at verses 10 and 11. 10 and 11. We hold this very, very dear and true. In this is love. And this verse specifically reminds me of John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son for it. But there's a special kind of love that is expressed to those who are first fruits, and I think that we would all agree without getting proud about it, right? We know that we've been called. We know that we have a very special opportunity here right within our grasp today. In this is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be the propitiation for our sins. Now, I knew God a little bit growing up as a kid. I had some good basics that were presented by my parents. I would say they were God-fearing people. They weren't churchgoers necessarily, occasionally, so often like good Protestants do, you know, to Christmas and Thanksgiving and, you know, various other services, Easter services during the year. They weren't churchgoers, but they had a framework of understanding God and godly principles and law, and they embedded that in us as kids. But so I knew God in a way, but I really didn't know God until I began to experience and understand what the church revealed to me in my latter teen years. But God sent his son to be a propitiation for our sins before I ever came into that knowledge, obviously. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. And therein lies the key that I believe will keep you safe in an age in which information is speedily and readily available. I know we probably didn't comprehend. I know I didn't comprehend. Maybe some of the geniuses amongst us did 25 years ago, had no clue as to how fast and how quickly information would be sped as prophesied by the prophet Daniel. And that knowledge would increase, and it carries with it a mixed blessing, or a blessing and a cursing at the same time. But notice verse 7. It says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God." So this is in itself so complex and hard to understand, right? This is so simple that, as my father-in-law is fond of saying, only a dullard would fail to comprehend the beauty of this. But this is the key to providing you with a stable relationship with God and with your brothers and sisters in the faith. In fact, as I was listening to Mr. Capo, I was struck by how similar the messages were, although we probably shouldn't even say that because that should be just implied. But, you know, I didn't even know Mr. Capo was going to speak today until we got here. So, in fact, beginning with verse 7, there are 7 very pointed and direct commands to love one another in this chapter. Verses 7, verses 8, 11, 12, 20, 2 times, and then in verse 21. I don't think I really had to gin that up to get to 7. 7 is a number of perfection, but, you know, either directly or indirectly, we are told to love one another, and so I kind of get the hint that that applies to me, and that is something that I have to do. You know, I could cite a lot of examples, but I know that many of you know that there is certainly no dearth of information available about the Church of God and what happens in the Church of God to, what, 95 to 99% of us that have access to modern technology, don't we? I mean, we're exposed to it in one way or another. And it's not that technology is wrong. It's never a tool that is wrong. As Mr. Armstrong always said, it's the use of something that could be wrong, not necessarily is wrong, but could be wrong. In Ephesians, I'm not going to turn there, you know this. In Ephesians, in chapter 6, Paul speaks of the fiery darts of the wicked one. So what are these darts? I believe that James chapter 3, verses 5 through 6, show us by implication that these darts, which are intended to do damage, are these. And this is not a full list, but rumor, innuendo, falsehood, and accusation. James says in chapter 3, verses 5 and 6, "Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. And the tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell." I mean, that's the origin of the fiery darts of the wicked, as we know. And so when you see rumor, gossip, slander, accusation, you only have one choice. You've got to discredit that in your own mind and in your own view, and you've got to fight that with the only antidote that there is, and that is applying love to the situation, applying the law of God to a situation. It's unfortunate that, you know, maybe the greatest use of modern technology has sometimes cast doubt on our work, you know, and questioned the integrity of people and been the medium to cast aspersions on people's character and institutional character. And that has actually taken place ever since we formed as a corporate body. You know, I believe the corporate body is a part, you know, it's the corporate body is not the Church of Jesus Christ. We all know that. It's a corporation and it enables us to do certain business things. There are others who believe as we do, and they are brothers and sisters in the faith, and we know that. But the answer lies in spiritual solutions. And Mr. Armstrong always used to say, and I, you know, I heard this so often that I kind of discount it. And then later on, you know, as the years went by, I realized how true it was that our problems are spiritual in nature, and we have to apply spiritual solutions. And it's not as though some great spiritual force is going to come down from Mount Sinai and somehow captivate all of us and capture us and just force some kind of solution in a spiritual way, you know, by, you know, what happened on the day of Pentecost in 31 AD. Because now we are empowered with the Spirit of God and we have to apply, just as Mr. Capo said, we have to apply those laws when we need to. You know, Matthew 18:15, going to your brother alone, solving, you know, leaving your gift at the altar and, you know, going and reconciling with your brother. Those are hard things to do, as he mentioned, but they are very, very necessary. Now, believe me, I'm not speaking to you in a personal way about something that you need to do, because I have no knowledge of you having to do this and employ this in your life. But I do know that it is a church-wide problem, and you should pray that we would have the courage to fulfill the law of God and the love of God by doing this, whether it's in the ministry or the membership or anything else. I came upon an individual this summer who had some, not around here, by the way, but he had some very great upsetness in his life and anger and hostility, and he was mad about this and mad about that. He's a church member, and he was upset. And I said, look, he didn't know me, and I don't know him. I've still never met him. But I said, and it wasn't about me. It wasn't anything he had, you know, who knows me anyway. But this individual, I said, look, I just wrote to him. I found his email address, and I wrote to him, and I said, why don't we talk? Why don't you give me a call? And I don't think that I was able to assuage all of his concerns, but at least I found that, speaking on the phone, I judged him to be a reasonable person, somebody that I could talk with, somebody that I could reason with, somebody within whom there was the Spirit of God present. And you know that. I mean, you can come to that understanding. You can understand that. And so I thought, you know, I have a responsibility and an obligation as a Christian, maybe even as a minister, not his minister, but as a minister, as a Christian, as an individual who is a part of this body, I have a responsibility to help him. And, you know, some of the things he's written are very, very damaging. I hope that he'll understand that. But at any rate, so I'm not speaking about a local thing. But there are many, many other solutions which are spiritual and myriad that we can employ. But unfortunately, we can get ourselves into wrong attitudes, come to wrong conclusions based on false or old information. We don't give the benefit of the doubt, or sometimes remain smugly self-righteous and, you know, throwing an accusatory finger out at our brother and sister in the faith. But the antidote is just this very simple aspect of having love and regard for each other. In 1 Corinthians 13 and in verse 4, it says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek his own, is not provoked, thinks no evil. The same basic concepts that are espoused, Mr. Capo was reading in the book of James. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. I believe that 1 John 4 and that whole chapter is intended for the church today too. I really believe there is a message there that we can utilize as we face difficult time, because, you know, time after time it seems like just so hard to get over the hump. Why is it? Well, I think part of the reason is us. We are the enemy. We sometimes don't employ these spiritual solutions, you know, and so we don't recognize that we have an enemy that is there seeking to divide and conquer us. But he is there. It is there, and it's present all the time. But there is absolutely no way that that presence can overcome you or any of us if we have the love of God perfected in our hearts. I'm not there yet. I'm the first one to admit it. I have not arrived. It's going to be a lifetime of trying to arrive. But I submit to you that that is the ultimate solution that we need to position ourselves for. That needs to be our goal, to have the love of God perfected in our hearts. Because when you have that, you are able to test and try the spirits. That is, the teachings or the individual or the whatever it is, the spiritual force behind whatever is the certain problem of the day. The antidote is love, the expression of God's love, and that is, that will wipe away the enemy, that will totally cover everything. So if anyone, I believe that ultimately this is what we can come up with after reading this chapter. If anyone comes to you without the qualities of 1 Corinthians 13, you should be on spiritual alert. You don't attack, but you need to be ready to stand, as it says in Ephesians, putting on the whole armor of God. Apply the law of loving your brother as yourself, and as your mom told you, don't believe everything you read or hear. Put it to the test.